Welcome to What the Book, where we discuss all things writing and indie author related. Your hosts are myself, international best-selling author Cintra Sullivan. Good evening, bookers. I also have my amazing co-host, the supremely talented horror author Kay Banning Callum. Hi, Caleb.
Hey.
And the phenomenally creative epic fantasy author David Atherton Cooper. Hi, David.
Good evening. Nice to be here.
How are you both tonight?
Oh, pretty good.
I am good now. You know, this is always the funnest time of my damn week right here. So, you know, things is looking up.
It's a nice therapy session for us all, isn't it, really?
It is. The beer is flowing. The sun's just heading down to the horizon. It's a good time of day.
It's a great way to relieve ourselves from the book stress of the week. And this week, bookers, we're going to discuss a subject that it can polarize people, certainly has done on a question that I asked, and that is, of course, the book to movie transfer. When you read a book and you totally and 100% fall in utter love with these characters that an author has written for you, consumed, engulfed with them, and then they make a movie of it and you're watching it going, what the fuck did they do to my book? None of the characters look right. They don't speak right. They're not the right height. They're not the right weight. They're not the right look. And honestly, it's hard to get your head around the differences sometimes when you read the book versus watching the movie. When I Googled the Buzz, I love a bit of BuzzFeed, first one that came up was Beautiful Creatures. Now, I don't know, I'm suspecting that David and Caleb have not read Beautiful Creatures, the book. However, personally, one of my favorite books, and they butchered the movie something fierce, and I can't watch it again. Once was enough. I cannot watch it again. Because the atrocities that happened on that screen have scarred me for life. Caleb, have you got any films that have scarred you for life?
Well, here we go. Now we're going to kick this one off. I'm trying to determine when the best part to slide this one in here is, because I actually completely disagree with the whole concept of comparing the books to the movies and determining one to be better or one to be worse. So I actually do not believe that it's possible for a movie to be better than the book or the book to be better than the movie. And I will explain all of that and more. But first, let me answer your question. As far as a movie that has scarred me for life, well, I'll tell you, it has nothing to do with it being a book. But Jesus Christ, that freaking crowdfunded Jeepers Creepers 3 nonsense that came out a couple of years ago. I mean, holy fuck, why? That was terrible. But no, I actually have a whole system on this, a whole freaking eulogy to go into as to why this needs to be laid to rest. And I will. But first, like I said, that's going to be something we're going to have to bring up, I think, maybe after a bit, because it's going to kind of just, it's going to be a pipe bomb, baby.
It's going to be a pipe bomb. But look, I'm not even talking sequels. Jeepers Creepers 3. Sequels are a whole different podcast altogether, and don't get me started on that. It's ridiculous. David, do you have any movies that have scarred you from a book a book point of view?
Oh, from a book point of view. So plot spoilers. I think I probably am with Caleb here on the whole book movie thing. Nail my colours to the mast. If someone wants to offer me $1 squillion to take one of my hard-crafted, blood, sweat and tears, epic fantasy novels and turn it into something fabulous that everyone can watch, I will take the money and laugh myself all the way to the bank while I write another one.
Fuck yes.
So that's all good.
Good answer.
But with the book
thing,
did you
just swear, David? I think that's the first time I've heard you swear on this podcast.
I like to slide the occasional creative curse in there somewhere. Some utter dog fondler of the first water came up with the movie version of The Hobbit. They mortgaged and destroyed my childhood by taking what was a beautiful little story that I loved and decided it had to be a three movie franchise with extra orcs and wargs and fighty shit. And I'm like, oh, please don't go there. It could have been just one, would have been fine. No, they had to butcher it. So The Hobbit gets my zero Rotten Tomatoes or full-on Rotten Tomatoes score because
now see, I'm being left out to dry here with you two guys, obviously, because I swear to God, there is no amount of money that somebody can put in front, and I mean it with all earnesty, that there is no amount of money that would be able to purchase the rights to one of my books that altered my book to the point where it was no longer mine. I would not accept any money. And I have turned down publishing deals for this reason, because the dedication I have to my words and my characters is far surmountable to any amount of money that they can offer me. And when I posed this question on Twitter, that, Noville said that, and her hashtag is at Ivyon, Ivyon. Check her out. Her artwork is amazing. Anyway, that she would, depending on the terms of the contract, that she would not compromise creative control. Now, that's exactly the same that I'm saying, is that I would need, if somebody wanted to offer me a gazillion dollars for my book, but they wanted a change that was of, that changed the skeletal basis of my story, I would need to be the one making those changes to remain creatively in control of it. Where, say, Alex, the at Alex_McCarty, said that if they bought it, they can do what they want with it. Doesn't matter. That he, money is where that sits. ONG Richards went, nope, not going to happen. Sorcha Rowan, who writes amazing erotica, was, how much money are they offering? And I do believe, when I spoke to her, that she said that there are stories that she's more invested in and less invested in. So that would be a determining factor. Caleb, would you compromise your creativity in search of the almighty dollar?
Oh, absolutely. If somebody wants to, if somebody wants to buy any of my works and adapt it into film, by all fucking means, I mean, have at it.
But what if it's your name attached to it now, though? It's your name attached to this.
It's going
to
be my name. It's going to be in the credits of the movie. It's going to be inspired by the novel by, Cabe Vanacallum. Here's the thing. It's every time anybody reads our work, and this has always been my big opinion on creative control and our creative vision on our own work, just the act of somebody else reading our work, it's already adapted. It's adapted to their mind. So you might have been picturing a character looking and talking a certain way, but unless you really specifically describe it, guess what? Your blonde-haired, Valkyrie warrior woman is suddenly a redhead, archer, unless you specifically go into that. So adaptations of our work are happening every single time somebody reads our stuff. I don't try to hold on to every little nuance and every little detail and say mine, because the only way I can sell that book and share that story out there with anybody else is by being willing to accept the fact that everybody's brain is going to process the stuff differently. They're going to see the landscapes differently, the towns differently, the people differently, the voices are going to be different. It's already out of our creative control the minute we push it out there to the public. And that's fine. I have no problem with that. And if my ambition, if my concept, if my ideas can be adapted into yet another art form and be shared with yet another entire section of the viewing public out there, then by all means, of course. I wrote those stories. I put the ideas down to paper for the very purpose of sharing that out there with the world, telling a story, accepting the fact that it's going to be different to every person who reads it. So I'm cool with it. And getting paid ain't nothing wrong with that.
Look, I get it. I do. I understand. And I mean, Daniel, which his handle is at Happy Dog, he did mention that, say, the original Tarzan movie that was written when MGM movies took it over, they allowed the Tarzan character to be sold to make movies in it, you know, that weren't, so the character was bought and made movies from the character, not off the original book concept. Now, I almost thought that that was plausible. I mean, it did happen, of course, so it's not a wrong word, but that, you know, it happened. But for me, on a comfort zone, I thought, oh, yeah, I could sell a character. That would be all right. But then if suddenly my 6'6" boner man was, you know, 5'2" and 50 pounds and, you know, blonde and weird, and I couldn't do it. But they would have bought the rights to it so they could do that. And that would kill me.
But then, I'd go with the different art form argument every time. So, sure, any of my characters, they're mine in my head. But as soon as they're down on paper, they're kind of they're frozen, and they're a perception, a view of series of characters, series of events. And to me, it makes sense. They all tie up together, and I like what I've done. Great. So I would definitely echo Novile's response at Live On, where she said, you know, would want to keep creative control. Sure, I would love to be the executive producer on a movie about one of my stories. But guess what? The studios probably are not going to take a punt on me doing that. And so I wrote a story. I did it my way, put it out there. And that doesn't get changed just because someone else wants to take it and do something else with it. So it adds rather than just corrupts and changes. And sure, if it's a duff version that doesn't happen to resonate with my sense of art, well, then I've given away that control. But a stack load of cash makes up for a whole lot of principle. In this
example. You're killing me, though, because, all right, one of my favourite series of all time would be the Sookie Stackhouse series by Charlene Harris. I love mm-hmm. the Sookie Stackhouse. I don't know if you two have read it. It's quite possibly not, but sincerely.
But True Blood is True Blood,
the series. Okay. So the only part of True Blood that related to the book was the first season. There was literally bang on the book, except for the very last episode. And then it went on a whole different tangent. Now it went on for season after season after season, and very successfully, you know, that made $1 quadrillion out of that season, out of that series. But the amount of hate mail that Charlene Harris got over it because it wasn't following the books. So she copped it, even though they would have made the changes.
But take us back to the bad reviews podcast from a couple of weeks ago. You kind of have to ignore the bad reviews because...
Yeah, that's true.
Hey, if someone takes your story and does something else with it and pays you, you use the money to fund writing the next book that's even better and even closer to your own vision.
It's killing me because, you know, Vampire Academy, who made the BuzzFeed number 13 worst adaptation ever done, Dimitri, who is ranking top number 3 on book boyfriends for me, I swear to God, that man is delicious. Yet the man that they chose on the movie, nah, couldn't do it. Nah, totally lost me on it.
Well, here's kind of the real truth behind, you know, when you talk about the arts and everything else here, though. Even the term adaptation is not 100% accurate for adapting, book into a movie. Because they are two separate forms of art. Film and literature are not the same art form, not at all. Just like, you know, music and dance, though similar, are not the same art form. And people tend to lose sight of that. One, people completely neglect to remember that it would be, you know, logistically, you know, impossible. Just the logistics alone of adapting a book plot into a, you know, movie that now has to be brought into the real world with, you know, actors and real sets and real scenes. It's never going to happen. And it's and even if you could get very close, it's never going to happen for everybody. Because, you know, the same way somebody sees a castle in the book, every reader sees the castle differently. They see it a different color of bricks or a different amount of windows or a different drawbridge. And then you're going to have to go find a castle out there in Scotland or somewhere to film the thing at. And that may not look like the castle that anybody envisioned in their head in the book. So now it's just at best, a film adaptation of a book. And I just said it's not an adaptation, I know, but the film version, I suppose, is homage. And that is all it needs to be viewed as. That's the only connection. People forget that film and literature are mutually exclusive. You know, it's not, you can't just wave a wand and make it. I mean, even a movie script, even a playwright, all of that stuff is not the same as a book. You don't write a script the same way you write a novel. Even that art form is different. It's all very, very different. So it's impossible. It's impossible to ever get even a proper adaptation. And so homage, that's my opinion on it. A film version of a book is an homage to the book. It's not an adaptation, but people expect, they seem to have these, you know, calibrated expectations that it's going to be just like the book. When even if you and I read the exact same book, and then someone says, okay, describe that character, chances are we're not going to even have the same version of it. So we certainly can't expect it from, you know, people in real life filming the scenes.
Look, I get it, and I don't get it because, all right, so when I'm reading a book, though, I'm invested in that story. I've fallen in love with those characters, and that's 100 times worse if I'm actually writing the story. Those characters are real to me. Car is real to me. My dragon boys, Joe, who I'm riding at the moment, is a real person to me. Yes, I've been tested for insanity. I'm good, but that's the way the characters come to me. Now, for me to then give rights to somebody else to alter him, it doesn't sit well with me.
Yeah, and I mean that's absolutely fine. Like I would never sit there and be like, oh, you know, you're wrong for not. Well, no, I mean if that's how, you know, if that's your, you know, feelings on the matter, then by all means, that's it. I mean that means that that's 100% correct and accurate, you know, to you. And so I mean, yeah, I'm not sitting here trying to say anybody's wrong for feeling the way they do about, you know, giving up the rights to their book or anything like that. That is something that is very near and dear to each individual
And this,
writer, and that is only their decision.
absolutely, and this is why I said that this particular subject that we're discussing will polarize people because, you know, some authors are going to sit there like me and go, unless I'm in control of my words, you ain't touching them. That's fine, it's valid. Then you get other ones that just go, I finished the book, do what you want with it, don't really care, just give me the money. That's valid too. And any spectrum shade in between the two polar opposites is all valid too. And that's the nature of the question that we're asking.
But it is one that people have. It is a polarizing question because very few people are sat there and wouldn't have an opinion on it. It is one of those things. And look, I can't imagine that every indie author all throughout their career is going to get the studios banging their door down, going, "Hey, here's a deal." But you know, the ones that are lucky enough to, I guess, being a bit of a cynic, it would be interesting to see if anyone who had a strong opinion, not use Intra because you ain't going to change your mind, but how many would change their mind when there's a big fat check dangling in front of their face? I think there will be some, and there'll be others who will stick to their guns and go, nah, and just keep doing what they do. And that's an admirable position. It's a great way to be.
Right. And even then, you still have a matter of you kind of still have to look at everything on a different scale because, you know, privilege can be one of those things that comes into play in making those decisions. I mean, if somebody's an independent author and they've already had a lot of success, maybe in other parts of their lives, and they have tons of money in the bank, or they're, you know, they might have that privilege to sit there and say, no, I don't ever want to do a book deal. No, nobody's touching my characters. But the starving artist type, you know, who is literally, you know, working two jobs and, you know, writing in the little bit of spare time they have, and somehow this has happened, and now this could open up their entire lives for them. To hold them to that thing and say, oh no, you should stick to your guns and hold on to your creative, you know, don't take that deal. But at the same time, this is something that could be a once in a lifetime opportunity to, you know, to really use their craft, their art, to bring them up to the next, you know, phase of their life, to be able to support their family, maybe whatever it is. So even then, like I said, you always kind of have to look at everything so case by case, because, you know, some people can afford to say no, you know, and some people can't. And it doesn't mean the person who takes, even if they make a bad deal, even if it's like a, you know, like a really shitty low budget company and just, you know, does a straight to DVD version of it and it's terrible. Even then, you don't know the circumstances of the person who sold the rights. And it's really not fair to attack their artistic integrity, you know, because of that.
Just think if we could get a trauma film of one of our books. How cool would that be?
I could go for a cult following. Like, really, one of those movies is so bad. It's just so good. I could probably go for one of those with cult and have, you know, those that Rocky Horror feel to it where everyone dresses up at midnight and watches it on the love it. I would totally.
I love low budget horror films. I love them.
And you know, as you said, their judgment of others is something that I strive not to do. So everybody's choices are their own and valid for that. Because as you said, we don't know everybody else's situations. We certainly don't know what demons they're fighting or what they need to happen in their life. So you make the choices that you can make when you make them, and the ripples that come off that are ones that we have to deal with on an individual level. Our pride does not feed the family always. And I will stand by that as well. So I wouldn't sit there and go, I'm 100% would never do that. I would just need a little bit of, you know, let me write the change. That's all. Just let me write the change. Can I just write the change? And then you can give me the big change. I'm good with it then.
I think the big challenge to that, and I think, I don't know how often authors are present on the movie sets of their films. I don't know. Maybe somebody like Stephen King, he might be able to pop on there whenever he wants to. But for us versus, say, a director, we actually have it a lot easier. Yeah. In the sense that if we decide that all of a sudden we don't want our scene to be set, you know, like in a big forest, no, we want it to suddenly be, you know, on the plains. Well, that's easy. All we have to do is just, you know, edit it out. Okay, now they're out on the plains, not in the forest. But if you're on a movie set and you're going up to that director, you know, and saying, hey, you know what? I just don't think that actress looks like I don't know. I think, you know, now there's no way they'd be able to accommodate that. They, you know, now they'd have
Could
to.
Could you imagine it? You know, coming up there.
Yeah, there's no way. Yeah, it would be impossible.
I just don't see her as a blonde anymore. It's just not right. It just doesn't look right.
But those are the kind of changes that we as writers can make in our stories. I've done that before with characters where I've just been like, no, I just don't know. And, or sometimes their appearances will kind of blossom as I write them, and I'll kind of get a better idea of what they look like. Yeah. But with movies, you got to commit, you know, there's so much that goes into making film, and all of those commitments are usually front loaded. So if, you know, if the movie's supposed to be in the city and they spend the money and they get the permits and everything to film on these streets, and then all of a sudden it's like, you know what? No, I'm just picturing it more of a suburbanish. No, in the book, it wasn't a big city. It was a small city. You know, no, it's not going to work. It's almost kind of like when you let your kids learn to drive and, you know, you send them over, you know, to a driver's ed at school, or you send them, you know, out to drive with the driving teachers. Like, the parent's not going to go along. You know, you got to at some point say, okay, you know what? You go take my kid out there and bring him back a good driver, hopefully.
Hopefully.
And that's kind of, yeah, hopefully.
That's not a bad way to do it.
All right, so we're just going to go off to our guest author this week. Of course, It is. Oh, she's a personal friend of mine. I adore her. I have humped her leg in person at many a signing. It is the delightful Kaya Carrington Russell. She's an epic fantasy author, and I really hope that you love this interview. Check you soon, bookers. Welcome to our author interview for this week. I have with me, of course, the talented horror author Caleb Banning Callum. Hi, Caleb.
Hey, hey.
How are you today?
I am doing really awesome. I have found some really good news apparently about my vocals that I have just never known about.
Right off the bat. Is this where we're going today? Right off the bat.
Oh, hey, look, man. I'm happy to be a destination.
And this has now all got to do with our guest author today, which is the talented Kaya Carrington Russell. Hi, Kaya.
Hi, guys. I feel like I really put you in trouble there, didn't I, Decentra?
Okay, bookers. I swear I have to explain myself every week, and it seems to get more inappropriate every week we go on. I described Caleb to Kaya as having a
Tell the people about me. Tell the people about me.
I described Caleb as having a very fuckable voice, and so of course Kaya, being the gorgeous woman that she is, decided to enlighten him with my description of him. So there you go. Don't you agree? Come on, people, you have to listen. It's gorgeous.
Just listen to this buttery baritone flow forth as I just go, yeah. Look at y'all, man. I appreciate both y'all. I appreciate you for saying it, and I appreciate Kaya for telling me about it. Y'all a perfect tag team right there. Y'all a true icon.
Oh, if you came to tag teams, trust me, Kaya and I could totally do it.
You'd be out of your depth, Caleb. I'm sorry.
Most men would be really cool. All right, bookers. Kaya and I know each other quite well. We've been to a number of signings together, and we have many an inappropriate photo of the two of us, with shenanigans being held. So I love her to death. She is gorgeous. So, Kaya, my first question for you, my darling, is what made you start writing?
I was 15. Yeah, I was 15. And I started reading a lot of fantasy and paranormal. I wasn't a fan of schoolwork in general. I was quite an angsty teen, like most. So I used to sit in the back of my, you know, in the rooms when everyone was learning and sort of just do my own thing and read books, much to my teacher's irritation. And at that time, I was reading Cassandra Clare's books, The Mortal Instruments, and I actually...
Fantastic series.
It's so good, isn't it? That was my first book boyfriend, I would like to say. We actually had a family incident. So our house burnt down when I was 15. So that in itself, as a teenager, was like pretty intense and dramatic. So I had a couple of weeks off school from that and sort of just, I guess... It made me more angry with the world. Why me? Poor me, as it all always rolls into one. But and then I got the idea of my first book, The Three Immortal Blades, and I just kind of started writing, you know, a 15-year-old girl and as she went through her journey in fantasy. And that's how I started writing. And I would come home after work or come home after school every day and I would just write this book. And that's how I began my journey.
Fascinating. Go on, Caleb.
You're ready. I'm just
yeah.
Here we go. Bringing the voice. All right. So, you've traveled all over the world. Where do you find your inspiration? Now, I'm from New Orleans, so if you want to throw some props to my city, even if you've never been here, I will believe that beautiful lie.
I have not been to New Orleans as much as I want to go, though. I've heard great things. I have traveled in the States a lot. Sorry?
I said you don't want to come right now. We like the epicenter for crime.
Yeah, I don't think I'll be over there for a while. But I'll Google it and pretend that I'm visually there. But, Yeah, I love the States. I've traveled the States a lot, actually. I tried to move there about 3 years back, and I've done a lot of traveling throughout the UK and Europe as well. I just actually moved back from Scotland with all this coronavirus stuff. I had to come back home until it all blows over. But I don't know, it's really interesting because I started traveling for my books originally because I started doing like international signings. And when I started publishing, I was young, I was 19, and I came from a country town. So it was really scary for me to start traveling, but traveling by myself as well. And so my books originally were what pushed me to do that. But then as I started getting the taste for traveling and being by myself in different countries and different cultures and places, it really opened my eyes to the diversity that our world has. But it definitely impacted my writing because visually, you know, in Scotland and the UK, there's castles. And, you know, going to Greece, the sunsets, like America is America. So you definitely learn a lot of things from there as well. And it just, I don't know, I think what I used to do when looking, I was never particularly looking for inspiration, but when I was just walking through the streets or just walking by myself or going to fancy restaurants or doing things that I would never do by myself, that's actually what gave me inspiration for a lot of the things that I write in my books.
Awesome.
So where in the United States, where in the United States was the spot that you done visited over here?
I have so many. Manhattan, New York is my, like, the Central Park is my favorite place in the world. I love that park. And there's so many videos of me online singing squirrels, there's a squirrel, because we don't have squirrels here in Australia. So I get so distracted by it, and I'm usually jacked up on caffeine. So it's like a really bad situation for people walking past me thinking I'm off my nut. But I love it in New York. It's definitely, it's a city I want to live in for a few months, but something I know I couldn't live there for a long time. But another place in the States I really wanted to settle in, and I actually tried to move there, was South Carolina.
Okay, I gotta ask, what was the appeal? Are you going from New York to like the polar opposite, South Carolina? What drew you to South Carolina?
So originally, my assistant Julia Summers is from South Carolina, and I met her at my first New York signing. I bought her a plane ticket and brought her over, and we had our first event together, and that was amazing. And so we'd been working together for 2 years by then online, so it was kind of a weird emotional bond that we already had. And so meeting her in person, I was like, I love this woman. And then when the next year I went, I actually went to, she's from South Carolina, I went and I met her family, so her husband and her children, and they became a second family to me. I absolutely adore them. And then I met extended friends and family, and just the time that I spent there, it was just, I don't know, it a little bit reminded me of the country town that I was raised in, but it still wasn't, it wasn't the same. So it's just a really, the people there are just really, really lovely. And my hair looks amazing constantly there. Like there's something in the air that just puts my hair on point. And I'm a shallow person, so it was kind of conned in by that as well.
You in a right place.
I love it. I love it. Now, look, I completely get the squirrel fascination. There is many an American that I have said, seriously, if I get over there, you're just going to find me outside trying to train my minion army to do my bidding with a bag of nuts, because they fascinate the fuck out of me. I love them. They just look so damn cute. I would totally get on with the squirrel crew altogether. Now, your token series is fantasies, plus you've done some wolf books regarding with I've got you on Goodreads. See the Phantom Wolf in the series. And so your genre that I can see generally is fantasy based. Is that where you find your true self of your words, or where you relate to the best as a genre?
Yeah, absolutely. I've done numerous genres when it comes to fantasy and paranormal. I've done my Token Huntress series is vampire dystopian. The Shadow Minds Journal, that's dark psychological thriller across angels and demons. And I find that starting off, when I started with The Three Mortal Blades, it was young adult. And then I went into the Phantom Wolf series, and my writing's progressed over that time. But I think it also helped me hone in my skills as to what underlining messages in these worlds I specifically wanted to put out into the world. And I find I do enjoy writing contemporary, like I write contemporary romance and I enjoyed that, but I didn't find it as challenging. You know, it's a lot to do with relationships and the building of, you know, man and woman or whatever situation it might be. But I find it a lot more intense when it comes to fantasy, because not only are you creating these relationships, but usually the main character is going through, you know, against their own demons or the personal issues. And then, I don't know, when it comes to being able to have power as well, like physical power, where they can show that they're extremely strong in some aspect or physically show that they're very weak and diminishing because of, you know, some psychological as well with building a world around them. So it's kind of like everything is ticking. It's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle to me, trying to put everything into place and how it works to make it, one, as realistic as possible to the readers, but also it's a challenge for me to try and figure out what makes my main characters tick in that world as well. So I find fantasy a lot more expressive for me than the standard contemporary written piece, I guess.
Well, I totally get it, because I don't write contemporary. I write fantasy. Oh, well, not so much fantasy, more paranormal romance, humour, crap. But what I love about it is the same process, is that I don't like to be confined by humanity. I want to be able to express it beyond what we know as a human world. And once you take it past that, it's limitless and it's fantastic. And, yeah, I love it.
It is. It's the constant just challenging people's concept of the world that we live in now. And I guess, like, right now what's happening in the world's very relevant to that, because we're so used to every day going a certain way that when it all gets blown out of proportion, we don't know what to do. And I think in, you know, obviously in fantasy you structure that there is sort of a society or certain rules and you go against that. So I guess it's the subliminal messages you're putting in it as well that readers aren't as confronted by, because they just think it's fantasy, but they're still sort of picking up on that message as well.
So fantasy readers, do you think, does Kaia Carrington Russell think that fantasy readers and writers are better equipped to cope with the coronavirus than contemporary readers and writers?
Well, absolutely.
I mean, look, shit is bonkers right now. So, I mean, y'all summarized it so much prettier than I'm about to. I just say shit is bonkers, right? That's fantasy I wish I could wake the fuck up from.
I love it.
Caleb, your turn. Have you got a question for Kaia?
Oh, yeah. Well, I got a question for both y'all and myself. But we're going to let Kaia go first. I guess.
Okay.
All right. So, Kaia and all of us, if you was on a deserted island, what three things would you want to have with you? And it can't be like a jetpack to fly off the island. No cheating. It's got to be something. It's got to stay with you on the island.
I absolutely hate this question. The thing is I know I would not fucking survive on an island. So I'm like, well, I don't know. Give my three wishes to somebody else, because I have no survival skills in me. After coming off the last question of saying how fantasy authors are better equipped, I'm not. I would like to – so first I would want, like, a really amazing, like, treehouse that's fully equipped and doesn't let bugs in. That would be great. Second, I would usually say family and friends, but after being in quarantine for 13 days and isolating with my family, I'm going to be very selective of the companions I keep, but I would definitely need somebody, my sister or a best friend.
Deserted island, Kaia. Deserted island.
Oh, that's true. All right, they can come, I guess.
No people.
Oh, no.
I should have specified. Now, look, I messed up. I didn't specify that it's got to be something that could fit in the briefcase or something like that. So, you know what? I slipped up, so we're going to let Kaia just run with this. You want to bring a big old tree house? You want to bring a big old tree house with you? There you go.
Caleb, you're such a great person. Disintro, you can leave.
Thank you. Oh, my God. This is the best night for me in the world. I feel like I'm the damn star.
All right. So, what's your third thing?
Can I have animals then? Can I have like a little, like friends? Like little animal friends?
Are you fucking
squirrels? Can I have fucking
Snow
squirrels?
White or fucking, are you like fucking Snow White? Let me take my little bluebirds and what the hell, woman?
I can't. Oh no, I don't like this pressure. Yeah, I go with the squirrels. I want the squirrels.
What about you, Caleb?
Bring a tree house, you bring in people, and you bring in squirrels. You basically just transport in the park to this, this
exactly.
island.
Exactly. She just brought the whole life with her. Three things, Caleb. Come on. Three things. Bring it in. Come on.
Here we go. What would I want to bring? I would bring a mirror so that I could monitor my levels of insanity as I slowly fucking erode from my isolation. Let's see. Now, I would probably want to bring... Shit, boy, this question is hard. I'm the one that thought this damn question up, and I'm having trouble with it.
I've got mine sorted out. So let's, Brian, come on, three things.
Huh? Oh, Lordy. All right now. a physician's desk guide, so that if I screwed my legs up or some shit like that, I could look in there and maybe fix it. I don't know. And, a stat phone, a satellite phone, so I could call somebody to get mass off that island. That's it. Oh. And go bunt.
So you got contact with the outside world. Kaya's bringing the whole fucking land with her. She's just bringing everything. It's like the whole house.
I'd be a good farmer.
Dishwasher, bed, everything. She's got it all going on. And I'm sitting there going, Bookers, I stay traditional with this. Three things. Vodka, coffee, vibrator. Done. We're good. All right. Next question.
I didn't even think of that. No, I want what you have.
Honestly. What more do you need? I'm drunk, I'm caffeinated, and hello, big O. I'm good.
All three of them things.
Nothing else.
All three of them things is going to dehydrate the fuck out y'all.
I won't care by then.
But we'll die happy. Die happy.
I will have a great big smile on my face, and I'll be tanked. It won't matter.
I guess. Hey, look, I can't argue with that.
All right. Kai, what is coming up for you next? What is your current work in progress?
Ooh, I actually have a lot of projects at the moment. So obviously I've just started my YouTube channel, so that's fun. I've been interviewing other authors, which is fun. And then I'm also working on a new book, but I'm not allowed to tell anyone because this is actually a secret project. I've got two on the go. Then I'll be right. Yeah, like, woohoo! What is Kaya up to? It's very different to what I usually write. I know I'm usually such a big mouth, but I'm being a secretive person about it at the moment. And then I'll be writing the fourth book to the Token Huntress series.
Fantastic! Do you write all at the same time? Do you have them all going like at the same time?
Yeah, I do. So the one that I'm writing at the moment, I'm writing about since I've gotten back about 5,000-6,000 words a day, which is great. That's coming along quickly. And the second one is actually I'm co-writing with another paranormal romance author. So we've just started that. So I've got that on the go as well.
Huh. You've never asked me to co-write with you. I'm feeling I'm just going to go sit with Caleb now.
building my experience before I go to the best, you know.
I've humped your leg, woman. Damn it. I should be writing a book with you.
You'll need to do more than hump my leg, sweetheart, if you want to roll with me. Wink.
Oh, there's a challenge, Caleb. Did you hear that challenge, Caleb? Did you? Radio. Good Lord.
Radio, that's the most Australian thing you've ever said right there.
All right, so let's wind this up. So what I like to do is, what advice would you in the middle of work progress or just coming to the end of it and just about to press publish, what advice would you give them to start their journey off correctly?
Yeah, so definitely do your research on marketing. If you're choosing to self-publish, which I know a lot of people are because it's a very convenient option, make sure you do your research because it's not as easy as just clicking. And I made the same mistake. I was 19 when I published my first book. So I hit publish and I was surprised that I hadn't sold 1 million copies within the first week. And unfortunately, over the years, you learn very quickly that you need to learn how to market as well. So if you aren't experienced in marketing or if you have a larger budget than some, hire somebody who can and just make sure that you're treating it like a business. You know, it's different if you are choosing to traditionally publish and then send it off to agents, and that's fine and well, and they'll do a lot of it for you. But I still highly recommend that you you learn how to navigate around social media and learn to get a fan base.
Brilliant.
Absolutely. Caleb, did you have any last words for Kaya?
It's been an absolute pleasure, Kaya. We can do another interview. We can do a part two interview with you if you want to. That, in fact, I want to come on your YouTube channel. Look, folks out there, y'all check out Kaya Carrington-Russell on her YouTube channel. She's got some awesome author interviews going here. I subscribed, and I hope to be a guest on there one day.
Give us all your...
Yeah, this is the part. Tell out there where they can find you.
Yeah, so you can find me almost everywhere. So obviously YouTube is Kaya Carrington-Russell. You can find me on Facebook under Kaya Carrington-Russell Author. You can find me on Instagram under Kaya underscore Crystal, because Crystal is my middle name and it's shorter than Carrington-Russell. And Twitter, same thing, Kaya underscore Crystal. And then my website is KayaCarringtonRussell.com. So basically just put in my name and you should find me, hopefully.
I just subscribed to YouTube and followed you on Twitter. Please follow me back.
I will, absolutely. And I'd love to have you on the show. So, yes, I accept, Caleb. I will have you on my show.
I just want to hear his voice again. I know.
I do. But on this, I get to see your face as well, Caleb. So we're playing on my terms now.
Look out now. Skunk.
I don't know that one now. What's that Australian for?
Oh, okay. No, I know that's a different thing over there completely. And no, it doesn't mean that over here. It means that you're an attractive man. It doesn't mean some creepy, like, stuff.
Very much. Look, I did not expect to get flattered by being called a spunk tonight, but I'm going to tell you right now. No. This is a damn night in my life. I don't know what is going on here. I am happy.
All right. Thank you so much, Kaya, for joining What the Book today. We really appreciate having you on our podcast.
Right.
And, yeah, thank you so much.
And thank you, Caleb, of course, my amazing co-host with the voice that makes us all go, ah.
Also damn right.
All right, bookers, we're going to chuck back to the main podcast now. So we will see you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Welcome back to What the Book, which did it better, movies or the books? I'm here with Caleb and with Zintra, and that was an interview with Kaya Carrington-Russell. Hope you enjoyed. That was really fascinating. Hopefully we'll be able to get her back on at some point and carry on the conversation. But right now, which did it better? So we're talking about movie adaptations of books, or even the other way around, that we really liked. Zintra, do you have one that really got you that you think was great?
Movie adaptations that really worked for me. Look, you really can't go, for me personally, I can't go past It. Stephen King and It. I think a number of Stephen King books nailed It when they took them into the movies. I don't know whether it's perhaps horror might be an easier genre to see a transference over for the reader, being that, you know, when you create a villain per se that, you know, is dressed like a clown, or that, you know, carries a chainsaw or has a hockey mask or whatever, because those details are given within the book's words, that they have to, they're sort of so attached to that particular character that you can't possibly not have them in the film. So I think perhaps that genre is an easier transference over. I don't know. What do you think, Caleb?
Oh, man. I don't think any genre is necessarily any easier than the other. I mean, when you start talking about, of course, like sci-fi would probably be one of the most expensive, I would say, to convert, probably just because of the special effects requirements and everything like that. But no, you know, us horror writers, you know, there are things that we look at too. And, you know, it's a lot of times you're really just looking for those kind of ominous nuances to try to see if that's still there. And of course, you know, voice in horror is a big thing. What the villain, if it's a speaking villain, that's going to be a big part in the, you know, reader's head and stuff like that. So I don't know if I would say it's easier with any genre. I think there's matters of things that are more expensive or more complex. And then that depends on the studio, of course. I don't know.
I think that we're having disagreements today, aren't we, Caleb? I do agree that sci-fi would be hard because of the complexity of creating an entire different world. Where, say, my books books exist within a human world. They're paranormal creatures, but they exist within a human world. So, to a point, the reader knows what to expect on a environmental level. Where, say, if you were writing a sci-fi book and it's set, you know, in a parallel universe or a different planet or a different whatever, that the details would be monstrous to make sure that they were all ticked. And that's possibly where it would be harder to transfer over and perhaps cause more issues between the readers versus the movie watchers. I don't know. What do you think, David?
Well, see, most of the ones that I really enjoy, the stuff I like writing and reading and watching, is all fantasy with some sci-fi thrown in. So my possibly favourite author, Neil Gaiman, wrote one of his early books was called Stardust. Beautiful little fairy story. It's lovely to read and wonderfully written. It's really evocative. They made a movie of it, and they kept, for me, enough detail and enough authenticity from the story that when they changed certain pieces, spoiler alert, the changes fitted really nicely. The whole story still flowed. It felt quite like the original. But the one that absolutely got me, and we said this podcast is which was better than movies or the books. What gets me every time is the adaptation of comics. So all of those superhero movies, and the one that I didn't want to watch it, and I did, and I didn't, and I did, and I had to go and watch it again, was The Watchmen, which was one of the very first graphic novels I ever read, and they recreated the comic almost frame for frame. It was beautifully done. And they got that right level of authenticity. So, I mean, in their case, literally you can flick through the comic as the film is playing and see each scene is perfectly mirrored. So they had a visual template to go from. And sure, they diverged in a few areas, but essentially it is the same book. So for me, it comes down to, you know, are they close enough? Have they kept enough of that original that, and then sure, with sci-fi and fantasy, have they had enough of a budget to get the CGI in place? So The Watchmen, Stardust, Harry Potter, even Lord of the Rings, none of those would have had the impact and the success they had without all that amazing CGI to make it work. But at their heart, for me, it's that core of authenticity. They kept enough of the feel of the original that, sure, Gandalf in Lord of the Rings, I didn't imagine he looked like Ian McKellen, but guess what? You watch the movie for 5 minutes and he's Gandalf. So if there's enough there, the rest flows for me.
Interesting. One of the films that, or author to book transferences that I love the most, if I wasn't talking horror genre, would be Terry Pratchett.
Oh, yes.
One of the most phenomenal fantasy writers of all time, as far as I'm concerned. The adaptations made of, say, The Hogfather, loved it. Discworld, loved it. I've lost the name of the movie. What is it? The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That one. Fantastic adaptations, and completely got involved in it. It didn't detract from the book at all for me, or the books,
But actually, for me, I can't watch the Terry Pratchett adaptations. The books are too close to my heart, and the visualizations that they've done just don't. To me, they haven't had enough of a budget to do them properly. They've never done death properly.
Oh, really?
For my liking, and they do well with what they've got.
Yeah.
But it's just not. It's just not enough. Nah, I can't watch any of those.
Ah, oh, see, they worked for me. Now, see, this is it, isn't it? This is exactly our point, isn't it? Is that what works for one will not work for another. And this has got to do with, I guess, books, movies, music is across the border of all creativity, paintings, whatever. It doesn't matter.
Of course, because, you know, one of the oldest and truest statements ever in art is subjective. And
exactly.
That is, and the biggest thing that I try to get across, though, is, like I said, we should not even be comparing the books to the movies. We have to watch them exclusively.
Oh,
as separate forms of art. We have to want, you have to accept them as exclusive art forms with, you know, you can know where something came from. Absolutely. It's fine. But at the same time, you cannot expect a film to mimic a book any more than you can expect a book to mimic a film. Because, I mean, everything from just the way we absorb that content, the sensory process, you know, you don't read a movie and you know, you don't watch a book. You know, the entire process is different. How it goes into how we connect with it. Films tell the stories very differently than books tell the stories. And I think in the situations where people say, yes, I liked the movie. You know, the book was great. The movie was okay. I think it just genuinely means they liked the movie. And that's all that really is. And people who really just go in hating the movies, if you go in expecting it to be, you know, the book come to life, that means you're expecting that somehow your imagination is going to get projected onto a screen.
They need somebody's to get going, involved in all of these productions. Okay, that's just the
yeah. There's never going to be technology that's going to plug into the back of our heads and project our imagination out. It's never going to happen. So,
and you're very right in the fact that the way I see it would not be the way you see it or the way that David sees it. So even if I was involved in it, it's not going to be right to everybody. However, when you get those people, and I know a few that go, oh, I don't read the book, I wait for the movie. Okay, so in that instance, I'm trying to play devil's advocate here. Bookers, please help me. In that instance, if I've written the book and some dude, you know, Simon from down the street says, oh, I don't read the books, I watch the movies. And so the movie gets made and it's different from my book. It's changed, it's altered. Then he doesn't actually get to experience my words. He experiences some other person's adaptation or interpretation of my words. So the connection between him and me is null and void. I know I'm just chasing my own tail here. I swear I'm just chasing.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's null and void. I mean, we can always trace things back to the singular element to kind of find the truth. You go back to the beginning, and that's where it's going to be. Well, so even if it is, you know, the movie, it's still that movie would not have existed without your book, which would not have existed without your imagination. So if this is somebody who, you know, if Simon from down the street says that, well, he ain't going to read the book, he's going to go watch it. That means if you didn't have a movie, he wasn't never going to read your book anyway. So you have managed to, so you've still managed to tell your story, you know, in some form or another to somebody. And at least from my perspective as a writer, that's all, at the end of the day, all I am is a storyteller.
If I'm gonna give any advice then, if we're gonna deal with them as independently, as Caleb says, let's deal with books and movies as independent entities. They are not linked. You enjoy each of them as a solo piece of creativity. Yes, Caleb, is that right?
I'm saying that. Yeah, I mean, not everybody likes books the same way they like movies. I'm saying it's different things. It's like same
okay,
ways.
But
yeah.
Then we should not read and watch within the same 24-hour period, then.
Oh, but you did now. Poor Simon. Yeah, Simon obviously can't read with it when he's wearing mittens because he needs his fingers free.
No.
And so you're denying him the pleasure of your concept as reimagined and virtualized by a film company. What's wrong with that? And hopefully Simon gets inspired, and when he has the freedom of his arms again, he can go and buy the book and read what it really was meant to be. So they're different. They're different experiences. They're different visions of the same concept. But I would say, unless they're really schlocky, no offense, Bed, then they're both equally valid. And I wouldn't personally read the book and then watch the movie within 24 hours. But hey, why would we limit our audience?
Now, you see, I've read Hunger Games, the books are Hunger Games series. Now, I'm a big YA person. I love all genres, don't get me wrong. But I read the Hunger Games books. And then, of course, all the series came out. Now, there was a big gap between them. So when I watched the movies, even though they were different from the books or there were changes made in there, it didn't affect me anywhere near as much because there'd been a decent amount of time between the reading and the watching. So I guess to some point my brain had, kept the important parts of the story and let the movie fill in the rest of it. So maybe that's what I do.
One thing I will say that is kind of like overlooked, I do believe, and, if anybody knows me, it's one that there's two types of people on social media that drive me fucking crazy the most. And, one of them is the humble braggers and the other one are the gatekeepers. And, gatekeepers are like, especially in the writing community, they're obsessed that, reading books is the pure good thing and watching movies and TV is like the dumb thing. It's like the milk versus Coca-Cola thing from when we were kids. Fuck it all. If they're a gatekeeper, I'm going to shoot them down just because of that. But here's the thing. Everything can open a gate for something else. That's why gatekeepers suck because they keep the gate shut. I'm a gate opener. Shit, come on in. So as I've said in interviews before with other people, I liked to write growing up, but I was not like a book nerd. I wasn't always sitting around like reading books and shit like that. Stephen King was what got me really into it. And it was, watching his movies is what really got me just hooked on him. And when I realized that, it's like, well, some of the movies aren't coming out yet, but the books are already out. So I went and I got the books. And then I was like, holy shit, I love reading this stuff too. So it can be a gateway. It can be an introduction into things. I mean, I see a lot of people, a lot of your hardcore gatekeepers that they just sit there and they're like, I don't know why my kids don't like reading. I try to make them read two different books a week and they just don't like it. And it's like, well, no shit, when you're forcing them to do it. I mean, literature is an art form, which means it's meant to be taken in leisurely. And when you start saying, no, you have to do it. Well, then guess what? Congrats. You just ruined it for them. And so, yeah, let the arts find.
Yeah, it's just like being back at school. That's no fun.
Exactly.
But I agree. No gatekeeping. And when I speak about creative control of my books, that's purely on a personal basis. That is not advice to any other person ever. That's just purely on my own aspect of it. And I do wholeheartedly agree that the intake of creativity, whether it be through books or music or movies or paintings or drawings or whatever, is awesome, no matter which way you decide to take that information into you. There is somebody's blood, sweat and tears behind it, and it's all valid. I think that's where
one thing I'd take away from all this is actually, and I think we have talked about this in a previous cast, this whole idea that some people out there will write for a market. And if you're writing for something to become a screenplay and become a movie, great, all power to you, but that's really hard to do. You either need to have a deal with a studio already or a huge amount of luck. So I would still say what we write should be what we want to write. It should be our authentic voice and our authentic words. And sure, you can skew it a certain way, and there are, the publishers all have their rules and guidelines for what they'll accept and how they do it, but at the end of the day, the story has to be ours. We have to have love and emotion baked into that story for it to feel good for us to read it back. And then, brilliant, if someone else wants to publish it, if they want to make a movie of it, fantastic, that's a bonus.
Yeah, you're here.
I agree. All right, so I think we've discussed this enough. I do believe Caleb has a fun thing for us to do right at the end of this podcast. So bring it on, Caleb. What have we got?
Yeah, folks. So we're going to try to start putting in some cool little things at the end here, kind of surprise y'all and keep everybody on their toes. And tonight we are going to do a little round of what we call search or dare. We are going to give one another a word to look up in the Twitter search bar. First tweet that comes up with it is we will read out loud, unabashedly.
Bring it
up. Oh, God, I'm nervous. So,
who's going to present who the word? I just introduced the game here, folks. I didn't have a word.
I've got one for you, Caleb. All right.
Okay, ooh, one for me.
You brought the game. You're going to go first.
Okay, right? Give it to me.
My word that I want you to, or wordy phrase, two words.
Okay.
I feel like I should be doing charades. That I want you to search and read the first tweet that this could go so bad. The tweet that comes up is pineapple juice.
Pineapple juice. Okay. Mixes well with alcohol, I'll tell you that much. Here we go. All right, looking up pineapple juice. Oh, boy. Well, the first tweet is just like a meme. So let me do latest. We'll sort this by latest. So that is literally the first one. Oh, this was easy. Okay. Well, the first one is written. I don't know the language. It is not in. So the first one written in English, here we go, is from Yvette Highland. And it says, I love pineapple juice, heart emoji, pineapple emoji, pineapple emoji, pineapple emoji, pineapple emoji, pineapple emoji. And that's that was easy. Okay.
She loves pineapple juice. Okay.
That's some big pineapple juice love right there.
All right, who's next?
Go on then, do your worst.
Caleb, you choose.
Okay. Okay, here we go. I'm trying to think of a good one. Oh, here we go. Okay. I'm gonna throw this one to David. All right. David, I want you to look up neckbeard. One word.
Neckbeard. is this a deep south thing?
Not at all.
It's gonna be nice.
All right, so search that, then go to the latest tweet. And tell me what you got.
I would love to read that one out, but that is deeply, deeply offensive. We'll keep that one. Hang on. So the latest.
Can you screenshot it for me for
so
later?
So from some classic dude calling himself Crayon Eating Retard, we have Reddit is like a parasite. I downloaded it during a time in my life when it was tough. I was ugly as fuck with a neck beard and not so good looking long hair, with also being fatter too. It made things even worse. I finally deleted it. So expect more posts to come.
Oh, wait, one of two. Let's get that other one.
Show this thread. Where are we? That's not one of two. That's one of four. Nice. Craning, eating retard. Learn to count. I've gotten better now. I've lost weight. Oh, this is awesome. I've made myself look more presentable. Good. Off to hell Reddit goes. Here on Twitter, it's more nicer. It's more nicer. Instead of the constant agony of Reddit's users complaining about the smallest things, humor was so shit on Reddit too. This person is awesome. I love them.
And they're spelling humor with a U, so they're either from y'all side of the damn ocean or from Canada.
Oh, God.
It is just possible that they are from the motherland, but they're using the term neckbeard. I'm guessing Canada.
That's hilarious.
I love the fact that he goes, that he blames Reddit for so much of his fucking problems and blames and thanks Twitter for just saving his fucking life, because he says, I was ugly as fuck with a neck beard. Oh.
But where does that get old? We all know that the Twitter is great, and obviously Reddit is just parasitical hell.
I love the tip of my tongue subreddits, though, because I swear to God, they helped me figure out so much bullshit over there.
Oh, I'm trying to breathe through this. This is hilarious. Oh,
David, you was a champ on that. You maintain like a whole nice little fucking, you know, tone and pace and everything.
Oh, God.
yeah, that's the beer talking, but whoever Crayon Eating Retard is, I love your stuff. That is good.
Oh, my God. You got to read their fucking like little profile thing. Literally, they say a twat and a hell of a coomer. What the fuck? Oh, that's What's a coomer?
Hang on, I've got to find out who this is. Crayon reading what?
Do not Google this on work.
At Retro Night Owl is their fucking at. So there you go.
All right, hang on, because I've got to find out who this dude is. Now you've got me all intrigued. At what?
It's at Retro Night Owl.
Retro. Retro Night Owl. All right, let me see where you are. Oh, there we are. Hello. Oh, a twat and a hell of a what, a coomer.
What's a coomer?
I'm not sure what a coomer is.
Again, we're following the theory of Canadianness here.
But he's been he? Am I assuming male? It's not really clear on the profile picture.
I mean, he was bitching about a neck beard and sucking at Reddit and everything like that. That's a fucking dude. I mean, there's no other fucking way. Coomer, I'm looking it up. Okay. Of course, it's some internet meme bullshit. It says, is an internet meme based on illustration of a scraggly male character who is mocked as an excessive masturbator. More broadly. Okay. So a coomer is basically, it says that, they jack off a lot. And yeah. And that is what he refers to himself in his goddamn profile. Then shit, so this dude's.
He's a twat and a hell of a wanker. Is this what we're saying?
I mean, that's what his profile is saying.
Practice makes perfect. Practice makes perfect. Don't knock it.
All right. Give me my word. Let's go.
Yeah, David, you got to throw one to Central.
Retard. More power to you. Love your work. Hit me with it, David.
What are we going to? Well, I think probably. I'll take you back to my favorite curse. We're going to look for mouth breather.
Oh, okay. Mouth. Is this one word?
When I use it, it's hyphenated, but I'm British.
Mouth breather. All right. Up to latest, because we're going to go tweet, not people.
Are you looking it up as one word or two so we can make sure we find the same thing?
I looked it up as two.
Okay, yeah, I did too. All right, here we go. Latest tweet.
Which is from Iceberg at Ice.
They do seem to have got the word about
Kenji,
right.
I feel like I should lower my voice for this. Meet me outside in front of the flagpole, you mouth breather. Oh, look, I totally got a 1-900 number voice when I want it. You know?
Yes, you do. I had to look up who he was responding to. I want to see who Iceberg was all fucking pissed off about.
Okay. All
apparently
right.
It was somebody talking about a fucking video game or some shit. So somebody said...
Michael saying, what is this summit drama a thing? Some of y'all, I love that. Y'all would never last a day in the Xbox 360 game chat. They take their gaming very seriously.
I know, like, how would you...
gamers do, don't diss the gamers. This is serious
really
stuff.
Sexy, but it wasn't. It was more like, meet me outside in front, you flag. Out of the...
Come meet me by the flagpole. You mouth breather. Oh, my God.
Sexy. And it wasn't. It's not sexy. I've got to research before I go then. I really should have done that first. Okay, so meet me outside in front of the flagpole, you mouth breather.
See, you did a good job. Last week I said, try an accent out, and you was like, oh, no, I can't do it. And look at you, man. All you needed was a mouth breather and flagpole, and you got them crushed
I'm saddling
it.
Up.
You saddling up.
That was fun. I like that game. We should keep that on for and rotate a few different games for the readers or listeners to listen to. And, of course, if they have some fun ones for us to challenge us with words. This might be a good thing. If they have a tweet word that they want us to look up and see what we can find and have a little bit of a giggle.
Hit us with your best shot, folks.
Everybody needs a little bit of a giggle. All right, so that's our podcast for this week, I think, guys. We've certainly done our fair share of rambling. As always, it is an utter pleasure and humbled honour to be part of the podcast crew with our horror author, Kay Banning Callum. Please tell the bookers where to find you. Where's your links?
Yeah, check it out, folks. You can find me on Twitter at BanningK1979. And all of my links are in my pinned tweet. So just click them all, man. Just indulge and dive right the fuck on in.
Just find Kay Benning-Cullum and stalk him everywhere.
Everywhere.
You need milk, by the way, Callum. Just saying. All right, David Atherton Cooper, our fantasy author, where can the bookers find you?
Well, as I'm still slacking and haven't built the website yet, you can find me on the Twitter at
Kung We're still going to get on top of you with this website factor. It's going to have a time limit involved in this. Now, of course, bookies, you can find me at Cintra Sullivan, at Cintra Sullivan Author, at also Cintra Sullivan. I don't know, just type in the name. I'm everywhere. But if you want to speak to me in a personal basis, you're going to find me on the Twit. Twit's my home. Writing community is the place where you will always find me lurking in the shadows.
And we also have a Discord channel now. We keep forgetting to plug that goddamn thing, folks. Discord.
Yeah. We need to find a time where we can all get in there and get some readers in there so we can chat.
Yes,
that'll be fun. And it's just is it What the Book Pod at What the Book Discord? Is that what the handle is for that?
I tell you what, folks. Yeah, it's the What the Book podcast. But if y'all come on over to at What the Book on the Twitter, you'll find links to it right there. Yeah. Or just come on over. We'll get you there. Trust. Reach out. We'll get you there.
Absolutely. So that's Twitter at WTB podcast. Find us, stalk us, DM us. We're really approachable most times. Most times, I say. But generally, just come in contact with us. Give us some feedback. And like always, we will see you next week. Bye, Caleb. Bye, David.
Good night.
Bye. We'll see you soon.
Bye, bookers.